Do you ever ask yourself, who am I? What am I? What am I doing here? Those are many questions we all seek the answers for. In a moment, Sean Carroll joins us. His work, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself. I'm looking forward to this. He's with us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology and a noted author. He received his PhD back in 1993 from Harvard and recently has worked on the foundations of quantum mechanics, the era of time, the emergence of complexity. And here he is as we talk about his latest work, The Big Picture. Sean, always a pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks for having me on, George.
Looking forward to this. What have you been up to other than writing and writing and writing?
Well, mostly I've not been writing. Most of my day job, you know, is just doing physics, writing physics papers, thinking about, like you said, quantum mechanics and complexity and cosmology in the era of time.
Physics seems to be finding new things for us all the time. I mean, we're learning so much about the cosmos these days, aren't we?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely true. You know, it's always fun to talk about the things we don't quite yet understand. That's where we do our physics research. We don't just sort of look at the things we understand over and over again. But there is increasingly stuff we really do understand, and some of it is quite amazing.
What's driving this knowledge, this speed of knowledge?
I think it's a combination of things. You know, technology is a big thing. We can get data that surpasses anything we could before. When I was beginning graduate school in the late 1980s, we didn't know about dark energy and the acceleration of the universe. We hadn't detected the fluctuations in the leftover radiation from the Big Bang that grew into galaxies and planets. So we've come a long way, and it's really taught us quite a lot.
What inspired you to write The Big Picture?
Well, I've always thought that there is a connection between all the different ways that we talk about the world. I mean, I'm a physicist, and I talk in the book about biology and neuroscience and philosophy. And I quickly admit that these are not things that I'm an expert in. But I do think that no one is an expert in all of them, and yet they do have something to do with each other. So I think it's important to sort of show how the different fields are connected, how they can all make up part of this big picture.
And you have divided this book into six sections. I want to buzz through them real fast, then we'll break them down. They're all fascinating. Cosmos, understanding, essence, complexity, thinking, and caring. And let's talk about the way you broke it down that way. Cosmos, how come?
It wasn't easy because I actually struggled with the organization of the book quite a bit. There's a lot to say, and so figuring out what order to say it in what was tricky. But by cosmos, what I'm really talking about is not the specific rules by which our universe works, but the general properties of the universe. For example, just the fact that the universe is expanding and that there is an arrow of time, that we perceive the past as being different from the future, but also things like conservation of information. The information you need to specify the state of the universe is the same amount at any one moment in time. This is not hot breaking news. This goes back to the year 1800 and a French mathematician and physicist named Pierre-Simon Laplace. But still, it really, really rocks the boat in terms of how we think about how the fundamental nature of reality really works.
You know, Sean, we have always, as I led into you, wondered, why are we here? Who are we? You know, what are we doing here? And I've got to tell you, whenever I travel, for example, when I go to New York and you see people walking down, hundreds and thousands of people walking down the sidewalks, carrying briefcases, umbrellas, doing whatever they're doing. I'm wondering if each one of them is thinking that same thing, at least for a moment. Who am I? Where am I going? What am I doing? What am I doing here? What's this all about? I mean, life is very, very strange, isn't it?
It is, and I would like to think that they are asking themselves that question, that we all stop and ask ourselves that question. It's not that there should be any simple answer to that question. It's not like, oh, if you just sort of put your brains into it and think about it for a few minutes, you'll figure it out. But there is the worry that, you know, we've become more or less good at surviving in the world. You know, and thousands of years ago, we we're probably going to get damaged by some natural cause or something like that.
Sure.
Just come down with a sickness we didn't know how to cure, starve because there was insufficient food. We've solved those problems to some extent, and instead, we're still racing to, you know, make a little bit more money, do a little bit better, buy a little bit bigger car, and it would be nice to think that we all stood back a second and thought about why we're doing it all.
As a theoretical physicist, do you contemplate the Big Bang Theory? Because a lot of physicists these days are starting to toss that out the window.
No, I don't really think so. I mean, there always have been some people who toss the Big Bang Theory out the window, but it depends on exactly what you mean by the Big Bang Theory. Because cosmologists are very sloppy about this.
Mm-hmm.
There's what most, I think, of us would call the Big Bang model, which is not even about the very beginning of the universe. It's the whole story of the expansion of the universe and the cooling and the formation of galaxies and so forth. That's the Big Bang model, and that is absolutely well established. Now, what happens at the very beginning, what happens at T equals zero, you know, the first purported moment in the history of the universe, that is not established at all. We really, really don't know what happens there. Is it even the beginning of the universe, or was it just a phase passing from some pre-existing universe? We have no idea.
And it might be that.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's quite plausible that there was a universe before what we call the Big Bang. There was very different conditions, and we came out of them, and people like me are writing down suggestions for what that might be like. And we should admit that we're speculating because we don't have any data about it, but we're trying to figure out what might make sense.
Tell me the definition, the true definition of a theoretical physicist.
Well, theoretical physicist is someone who does physics, that is, thinks about the nature of the physical stuff that makes up the universe. And a theoretical physicist is the one who proposes the ideas both for how stuff behaves and also making predictions for what the data should say, as opposed to an experimental physicist or an observational physicist who actually collects that data, tries to do the experiment and see which way nature goes.
So an observational physicist would be the one at CERN, I would guess.
Well, I'm thinking more the word, it's just for sociological reasons, observation is more associated with astronomy. So if you measure the light left over from the Big Bang, you're doing observations. Whereas if you actually build something and smash things together yourself, even at CERN, you're an experimental physicist.
Interesting take in all of that. So we're going to get into things, by the way, about life and death and God and its existence, his existence, and get your take on all of that. What would you say today, Sean, is the most remarkable, exciting thing that physicists are working on today?
I don't want to weasel out of the question, but that's impossible to say because all physicists are going to give you a different answer to that.
Would they?
They're going to talk about what their special favorite thing is. For me, it's the long-running problem of the intersection of quantum mechanics and gravity, the quantum gravity problem. I think that really what we're beginning to catch on to is that space and time themselves are not going to turn out to be fundamental. They're going to be approximation. Just like we learned after hard experience that the table in front of you and the air in the room that you're in are not solid or gaseous at their most fundamental level. They're made of atoms. We're going to learn that space and time themselves are made of something else.
When you talk about the essence of complexity, what do you mean by that? The emergence of complexity?
That's a good question because complexity is one of those things where we've been thinking about it for a while now, pretty seriously, and yet there isn't any one agreed upon definition. For my purposes, both in the book and in the research that I do, we actually just took the simplest possible definition of complexity, if that makes any sense. And really, we're talking about the complexity of a configuration of stuff at any one moment of time. So a lot of people will talk about the complexity of a process or a computation. But we're just thinking about, like, take a picture of something. If the picture is all white everywhere or all pink everywhere or whatever, it's simple. If it's, you know, a checkerboard pattern, then it's a little bit more complicated. If it's an intricate swirl of fractals and things going on, then it'll be very, very complex.
You have done some consulting, right, with some of the creators of some recent Marvel movies?
Yeah, I've been a consultant for both TV and movies just a little bit.
And what do they want?
You know, different people want different things. And when, as soon as you start talking to people in movies or TV, you realize very quickly that it's not a single author process. It's not like writing a book where there's one person who's responsible for the whole thing. There's many, many people trying to steer the ship. And some of them might be very, very interested in science. Some of them might have no interest whatsoever. And I think that the ones who I work with, the ones who I respect on this edge of things, are really trying to understand the world that they're trying to create. Even if the world you're trying to create has Asgardians carrying giant hammers and people flying around in metal suits and so forth, it's still a world that needs to make sense. And that's what scientists are good at, trying to figure out what are the rules that this world has to obey. Because that's what gives us the constraints that makes for an interesting story.
As a matter of fact, Guardians of the Galaxy comes out next year, another one, Volume 2. Is that one of them, or Captain America?
I did not work on that. I worked on both of the Thor movies and a little bit on the Avengers.
Ah, the Avengers. That was they did a couple of those, too.
Yeah.
Now, when people talk about let's break the law of physics, how can you do that?
Well, you can't. If it's a real law of physics, you can do it in a movie. You can pretend that, for example, you can build a spaceship that goes faster than the speed of light or something like that.
Oh, I thought we were going to be able to do that in real.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to do that for real. Don't.
Oh.
Sorry. Probably not. You know, the great thing about science, one of the great things, is that we never get to 100% certainty. It's not like math or logic. You know, in math, 2 plus 2 just equals 4. There's really no way around that. That's not something you can hold up to doubt. In science, because we do experiments and we increase or decrease the probability we associated with a statement being true, it never goes to 0% or 100%. So I think that I would place a lot of money down on the bet that says we will never travel faster than the speed of light.
Will we get close?
Oh, yeah, we can get close. That's easy to get close. It's impossible to go over. That's just how physics works.
Interesting. If you were with Albert Einstein, Sean, right now, what would you two be talking about? What would you ask him?
I would definitely want to talk about quantum mechanics. You know, he was actually a pioneer of quantum mechanics, and later in life, he became very worried that people were taking it at face value and it couldn't be the whole story. He really thought there had to be something deeper underlying the quantum rules that we had invented in sort of ad hoc fashion. And I think that maybe today he would change his mind about that, but I'm very curious to find out.
And explain quantum mechanics for us.
Well, you need to first think about classical mechanics. That's what came.
All right, you're going to have to explain that too then.
So that's classical mechanics is what you got tortured with in your physics class in high school. When you're doing inclined planes and pendulums and frictionless surfaces and things, you know, pulleys and levers and all that.
Mr. Kiefer, I remember
there
him now.
Go. Exactly. It was Mr. Popovich for me. The story there is that you describe the world as some objects that have a location in space and also a velocity. So they have a position and a momentum, as we call it. And the laws of physics tell you, given the position and momentum, what will happen next. So you hit a baseball, you know where it is and how fast it's moving. Physics can tell you the trajectory it's going to go on. And in principle, if you work hard at it enough, you can observe that trajectory as well as you would like. Now, quantum mechanics comes along and says, actually, the world is totally different than that at a deep level. Instead of telling you, here is the position of a baseball, quantum mechanics says there is a wave function spread all throughout space. And that wave function tells you, if you were to observe the baseball, where would you see it? And if you're not looking at the baseball, if you're not observing it, then it is nowhere. There is only this wave function spread out all throughout the universe. That's the essence of quantum.
Interesting. And the fact that the gravitational waves have been detected, they say, confirming Einstein's theory, how important is that for us to really know that?
Well, it's important in two ways. I mean, it's important Because, like you say, it does confirm Einstein's theory in a way that it hadn't been before. That much wasn't really in doubt, you know. We thought that Einstein was right for a good time now.
And he did it without a computer, too.
He did it without a computer, pencil and paper and his brain and talking to friends. That's all that it required. But now that we have this, it's a tool. It's a tool both for testing Einstein's theory in even deeper regimes, learning what space-time is like right near a black hole, but also a tool for looking at the cosmos in a different way. Every time that astronomers have built a new kind of telescope to look at the universe, they've discovered something surprising and unexpected, whether it's radio telescopes or X-rays or cosmic rays. And now we have gravitational waves. And we were already surprised. The first thing we saw was this event where two black holes, 30 times the mass of the sun, spiraled into each other to make one big black hole. That is allowed, of course, but it's not what we expected to see. We think we kind of got lucky there.
Isn't there a huge black hole in the middle of the Milky Way galaxy, or is this what you're talking about?
No, there is a very big black hole in the middle of the Milky Way, several million times the mass of the sun.
Oh, my God.
The ones that we saw at LIGO, the gravitational wave detector, were 30 times the mass of the sun, so that's nowhere close.
Can we ever get sucked into this thing?
No. You know, black holes don't actually have more gravity than anything else with the same mass. They're just smaller, so we can get closer. You know, if the sun right now turned into a black hole with the same mass, the mass of the sun, the Earth would just spiral or spin around it in its orbit exactly like it does right now. The gravitational field out here would be completely unaltered.
The mechanics of all of this is really something in that it's predictable, isn't it?
Well, that's the difference between the classical world and the quantum world. In this classical world, which includes our best description of gravity through Einstein's general relativity, yes, everything is completely predictable. If you know the state of the universe at one moment in time, you can predict it in principle with perfect accuracy in the future and past. Now, of course, we don't have perfect information about the universe, so as a practical matter, that's not accessible to us, but in principle, it was there. And quantum mechanics comes along and says, actually, even in principle, the best you can predict is the probability that you'll get a certain answer. You can't actually predict the answer itself with 100% confidence.
Sean, we're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to talk with you more about your latest work, The Big Picture, but where do people get the book?
Anywhere you like. You can get on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any bookstore near you.
And, of course, your other books. You've been on the program before. We talked about The Particle at the End of the Universe, The Hunt for the Higgs Boson, which they claim they have found at CERN. There's so much more to talk about. Later on, we'll open up the phone lines. We'll take your pictures, too. And your pictures can be put on Instagram if you want to send them to Lex at coasttocoastam.com. Now, we're doing all kinds of new things right here at Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us at Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, and we'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. And don't forget, you can also email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. Hey, tomorrow, our chat, of course, for Coast Insiders will be John Hoag talking about all kinds of prophetic things. So jump on board. Those rooms fill up fast. Starts at 8 o'clock Pacific time for Coast Insiders. And welcome back with the theoretical physicist, Sean Carroll, as we talk about his work, The Big Picture. Sean, you are a booster for Isaac Newton. How come?
Well, I do think that Isaac Newton was the greatest physicist, maybe the greatest scientist and greatest mathematician who ever lived.
So. Really? That's quite a claim.
And he only sort of did science for half his life. He more or less retired and from science and moved to London and became the leader of the British Mint and hunted down counterfeiters later in his life.
What? How did he get involved in all of this? I mean, he was a great thinker. What turned him on? It wasn't an apple.
The story goes that he probably invented the apple story himself because he liked to burnish his own image. He had quite the ego. He was one of the original sock puppets, actually. Isaac Newton would write reviews of his own work and sign them with different people's names so that he would come out looking good. But, you know, he was a competitive guy. He was a brilliant guy. He was fascinated by religion as well as by science. Most of his good work was sort of a response to a challenge in one form or another. Someone said, like, we don't know the answer to this problem. No one will be able to solve it, or you can't do this, or how would you ever go about doing that? And he just sat down and figured stuff out.
Sean, do we have Isaac Newton brains today?
Yeah, probably, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. You have to be in the right place at the right time to be Isaac Newton. And he was, you know, he came right after Galileo and others had laid a lot of the groundwork. Galileo was a brilliant mind himself, but he didn't have the mathematical genius that Newton had. He was a much more intuitive physical thinker. So there's probably people like that around today, but who knows what they're doing? Maybe they're radio hosts. I don't know.
In one of the chapters and sections, you talk about caring. How does that fit in?
Well, I think that, you know, the point of view that I advocate in the book is naturalism, that, you know, there's only one world, the natural world, and it obeys the laws of nature, the laws of physics, or whatever you want to call them. And a lot of people get turned off by this point of view. They think that it sucks out meaning and mattering and purpose from the world. So I try to point out that even if we are made of atoms that obey the laws of physics, we still care about what happens to us, about what happens to other people. And that's the real source of why we judge certain things to be right or wrong, why we give purposes to our existence and so forth. It's the fact, simple fact, undeniable, that we actually do care what happens to us and to other people.
You address life after death, the existence or not existence of God. I want to spend some time on both of those. But overall, what is your thoughts on how life has evolved? Is it a roll of the dice, or is there some intelligence behind it?
I think that, yeah, I buy into the more or less conventional scientific explanation for this. There's two things we need to understand. One is the actual beginning of life, the origin of life, what scientists call abiogenesis, the transition from non-life to life. Life being something that can breathe, you know, not breathe, but soak in energy from its environment, sustain itself, and then eventually replicate itself. And once life can replicate itself, can hand down the information that makes it itself to another generation with a slight modification, then the second piece kicks in, which is Darwinian evolution, natural selection. The genetic information that gets passed down from generation to generation is not an exact copy. There will be slight changes from time to time. Usually those changes will be bad, but occasionally they will make the organism even more fit and interesting. And so that's how you go from a single-celled organism 4 billion years ago to all the wonderful diversity of life we see today.
And does it continue to change?
Yeah, absolutely. All forms of life are definitely changing, some faster than others. It depends on what your environment is. When your environment changes a lot, then your genome tends to change quite a bit.
And so when that physical being dies, a lot of us believe that it goes off into a different plane of existence, the spirit world.
Right.
What does physicist Carol have to say?
So I do not believe that. So I'm going to take the minority point of view here.
Oh, boy.
Probably for many people.
Wait till we open up the phone lines on this one.
That's okay. I'm happy to have the conversation. I think everyone should be thinking about this stuff. I think that, you know, the crucial insight for me is that life is not a thing. It's not a substance that fills you up and energizes you. Life is a process. Life is something that happens. It is very much like an enormously more complex version of a burning candle. You know, the candle can be burning or it cannot be burning. It's still the candle, but when it's going on and burning, that's a different kind of process happening. And the same thing is true for a living organism. It's a collection of stuff, of atoms and molecules acting in a certain way and going on, and at some point, that process stops, and that's the end. There's nothing more after that.
So it's all over?
Yes, that's right. So the last chapter of my book is called 3 Billion Heartbeats, because an average human being, just on average now, has a lifespan that is measured in human heartbeats of about 3 billion. And if you think that that's it, if you think that that's the entirety of your life, then every one of those heartbeats becomes quite precious, and you should do your best to make the life that you're actually living right now something special.
Doesn't that feel kind of empty?
No. Why would it?
I guess that's why you're the scientist.
You know, I tell the story, I give the example in the book that the writer Chris Johnson points out of the movie It's a Wonderful Life.
I love that movie.
Yeah, and it's an obvious religious message in It's a Wonderful Life.
Mm-hmm.
George Bailey,
yeah, I would think so.
Saved by an angel, you know, who
or at least down. A spiritual message.
That's right, spiritual at the very least. But what Chris Johnson points out is that what actually makes George Bailey realize that his life has meaning is not some devotion to a higher power. It's the demonstration that he has had an impact on the actual lives of actual people living in the town of Bedford Falls. It's the real tangible impact in the world around him that really, really matters. And I think that that's all that ever matters. The people we know and love and care about, the world that we live in and affect, that is what matters.
So then we move on to the big question about God and its creator, the creator of everything. I'm going to guess that you don't believe in God.
That is correct. You guessed correctly.
How did I know that?
Well, if you read the book, it would be
Well, you're giving that away then. But
you don't get a lot of points for that. But
now, did you ever believe in God when you were a kid?
I did. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a fairly standard Episcopalian household. And went to church Sundays, Trinity Cathedral in Trenton, New Jersey, and loved the big wooden pews and the stained glass windows and the hymns and the whole bit.
What changed your mind, your views?
It was gradual, but, you know, as I learned more, you know, my change in views mirrored humanity's change in views. As I learned more about how the world works, it just seemed increasingly implausible that God played a big role in it. And as I became convinced that the universe doesn't need to be created or sustained or guided, it can just be, then the purpose of God seemed to evaporate.
But doesn't it baffle you that that phrase alone, that it just is, isn't that strange? That something as vast as the universe, as complex as the universe, as organized as the universe, as wonderful as the universe, and that includes us, that it just happened?
Yeah, I think that this is you really put your finger on what I think is one of the biggest reasons why people do believe in God. I mean, it helps provide an explanation for why the universe exists. Now, what a non-believer would say is, okay, but then why does God exist? You know, where did he come from? And a well-trained theologian has a set of answers to that. There's a certain dance you can do about how the universe is contingent, it didn't have to exist, but God is necessary, and so forth. But at the end of the day, God isn't necessary. The universe can just be. And this is certainly the lesson of the last 500 years of studying the universe that we've seen, that you don't need a mover to explain motion in the universe. Motion is natural. Existence is natural. It is a huge change in mindset from what you might think of as your understanding of the intuitive everyday world. That I'm very happy to grant you. And so people find it difficult to do, but once you make that shift in paradigm, you go, yeah, okay, that makes a lot more sense.
See, I'm not very religious. I think I'm very spiritual, but I'm not very religious. And I have a difficult time trying to contemplate what is a God, what's it supposed to be. I don't think it's a man. I don't think it's a woman. I just think it is. My mother once told me, Sean, that God always was and always will be. And it kind of sounds like a definition for the universe, doesn't it?
Well,
always was,
yeah, that
always will be.
You know, these kinds of questions that we have to approach them, keeping in mind that once we go very, very far outside our everyday experience, our intuition and our feelings for what is natural and unnatural are more or less useless, right? I mean, we're so far outside the everyday world. So when you say that something always is, always was, and always will be, that begs the question of whether or not time itself is eternal or finite in duration. Was there a beginning to time itself? So the universe, I think, exists whenever time does and not when time doesn't, but I don't know whether that span of time is finite or infinite.
See, I've always believed that there's something behind all of this, some kind of driving force. I don't know what it is, but there's something there. You know, when we talk about life after death, I mean, I can't tell you how many calls I get from people who aren't making things up. I mean, these are cases that are happening where they see ghosts, they see spirits, they see strange things happen. And I can't negate that. Maybe you can, but I just can't say that they're all nuts or they're seeing things. Something's happening to these people.
Well, I don't like to say that they're nuts or they're seeing things or they're deluded or anything like that. I mean, people might be very sincere. There are obviously a lot of cases that are fake. That does happen sometimes. There have been some bestsellers recently where people claim to get evidence for heaven and then later admitted that they just made it all up. But I think that's not the majority of cases. I think that people are being honest with themselves. But the truth is that human beings are just terrible at accurately reconstructing what they think that they saw. You know, that study after study has shown how bad eyewitness testimony really is at accurately portraying things that happened. Our brains are very, very suggestible in a huge number of ways. So we have to balance the eyewitness testimony that we get, that people saw ghosts or spirits or whatever, versus the fact that if that's true, it represents some complete violation of everything that we know about how the world behaves. And I think it's much easier to explain these claims in terms of people making honest mistakes than in terms of the whole fabric of reality being subject to dramatic division.
What would it take for you to believe that we exist beyond the physical realm?
Well, I would definitely be willing to change my mind if good evidence came along. I mean, it would have to be, this is something that the philosopher David Hume pointed out years ago, that the bigger the claim, the more this claim violates what we think we know about the world, the stronger the evidence has to be. It can't just be anecdotes, this person and that person. It has to be, you know, in my mind, if there was life after death and there were spirits who survived and could in any way communicate with us back here on Earth, it would be incredibly obvious. You know, the afterlife would be as obvious as the existence of Canada. You know, it wouldn't be like this thing where it's just some stories that are told between this person and that person. Everybody would see it all the time. But that's not at all what you see. It's always on the edge of not quite being reproducible or many people seeing the same things and different stories say different things. And you just need a lot clearer picture than what we currently have.
And then with back to the God thing, what kind of evidence would get you to believe in an existence of a God, of which I will agree the definition is very vague?
Yeah, you know, I think the vagueness of the definition is part of the problem. Different people have different opinions about it. Ever since Spinoza, another famous philosopher, there's been at least one strand that just defines God to be the universe. In that case, I believe in God because I believe in the universe. That's no problem. But I think a more traditional view holds God to be a kind of a person apart from the universe, a creator and sustainer of the world, someone who has, you know, who cares about us human beings. And again, I think that the thing that we should do is ask, if that were our world, what would we expect the world to look like if we didn't already know what the world looked like? So, for example, if every religion in the world over all of human history came up with the same story about what God is, what he wanted from human beings, even though they were widely separated in geographic location or time or something like that, that would, to me, would be evidence that God was actually talking to these people. If God didn't exist, then I could easily imagine people making him up. People make up stories all the time, but in different parts of the world, in different societies, they would make up different stories about what God was, what he wanted, how he interacted with human beings. And that's exactly what we actually see in the world.
We're going to take calls with you next hour, Sean, and the hour after. You're with us for two more hours, and we'll get some perspective from many of our listeners into many of the things we have been talking about. You have talked about human life as something like a swirl of cream in a cup of coffee that you talk about in the first chapter. How come? Well, what are we?
There's one issue that is raised by people who are questioning or skeptical about the traditional scientific account of the universe, which is that the universe, we're told, is winding down. It's becoming more chaotic and disorderly over time. The entropy of the universe, which is a measure of how random it is, started very small near the Big Bang, and it's becoming bigger and bigger all the time. And if that's true, the story goes, how could it be possible that something as intricate and complicated as a living being, much less a human being, could come into existence in a universe that was just winding down? And I think that this is something where, on the one hand, science does not have all the answers right now. This is a very primitive state of our knowledge. We don't have anything like a finished product in terms of understanding that stuff. But on the other hand, we do have the outline of an understanding for why complex structures should come into existence at all, even though the world is becoming more chaotic and random. And
all
that's
right.
Where the cup of coffee comes in. If you stir cream into your coffee, it starts very, very simple. And when you're done stirring and it's all mixed up, it will be simple again.
Sean, we're going to come back and take calls with you and chat more about your latest work, The Big Picture. So he doesn't believe in life after death or God. Remember that when you make your call.